Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Michael Polignano. Our first segment today is Countercurrents editor Greg Johnson reading his essay, Hegemony.
In September of 2001, just after the September 11th terrorist attacks, I flew to Paris to attend the Front National's Fête de Bleu-Blanc Rouge, which is a political rally and fair attended by tens of thousands of French nationalists, plus well-wishers from around the world. Before the event began, I also attended an impromptu meeting of Anglophone nationalists from the U.S., Canada, and Great Britain. When the topic of 9/11 came up, there was a very instructive disagreement. The Americans wanted to emphasize the role of Jewish domination of American foreign policy in causing 9/11. England, however, has a much larger Muslim population per capita than the U.S., and many of the Englishmen present had witnessed the jubilation of Muslims at the attacks, so they emphasized the problem with Muslim immigration. Of course, they were both right. The 9/11 attacks could not have happened without Jewish domination or Muslim immigration. As I listened to the discussion becoming more and more heated, it dawned on me that no matter what side one takes on the question, do we blame the Jews or the Muslims, white people really can't lose, since we want to free ourselves of both Jews and Muslims. I had always thought of politics as a matter of winning arguments, that is to say, being on the prevailing side in debates about political issues. But it occurred to me that there is a power greater than that of winning an argument. That is the power to frame an argument, to set the parameters of debate, so that one always wins, no matter what the outcome. It's a case of saying, heads I win, tails you lose. A couple of years later, Mike Polignano and I went to a movie in Berkeley. Before the trailers for upcoming films, they showed advertisements. One ad featured a contest between Coke and Diet Coke. I smiled and remarked, that's a contest the Coca-Cola Corporation can't lose. Getting people to debate questions like, do we blame the Muslims or the Jews, is a form of political control. Once the public argues within these parameters, we don't need to worry about the outcome. Whites really can't lose. Or, to be precise, the only way we could lose is by failing to understand the nature of the question, taking one side too seriously, and developing hard feelings towards our quote-unquote opponents. To avoid that outcome, one must not only frame the question, one also needs to control both sides of the debate. We must do more than script political theater, we must also stage it. But one needs to make sure that the actors don't take their roles too seriously. This is nerf ball, not hardball. Stage fighting, not real fighting. One guy takes a swing, the other jerks his head back, and the sound effects guy creates a smack. It just has to look real to the people in the audience. The ring announcers and the talking heads do all the rest, selling people on the idea that what they are seeing is a real contest. Controlling the political realm by framing and stage-managing political debate is a form of what is called hegemony. Hegemony comes from the Greek word hegemonia. It means leadership, domination, rule. But it is not just any kind of rule. For the ancient Greeks, hegemony referred to imperial or federal leadership, in which the hegemon rules over other states with regard to foreign and military affairs, but leaves domestic matters in their hands. For the man on the street, therefore, hegemony appears as a distant, indirect, mediated, soft form of political domination, although, of course, hegemons had the power to make war on recalcitrant followers. Hegemony can also take a cultural form, ruling over the political realm by shaping the values and ideas that set the parameters and goals of specifically political activity, including debate. In other words, cultural hegemony is a matter of metapolitics. Thus, hegemony is the key concept for the metapolitical project of the North American New Right. If political power ultimately flows from the barrel of a gun, metapolitics determines who aims a gun, at whom it is aimed, and why. If political power is hard power, because it ultimately reduces to force, metapolitical hegemony is soft power that ultimately reduces to persuasion. Persuasion is a matter of rhetoric which involves rational argument but cannot be reduced to it. Cultural hegemony is the secret of the soft form of Jewish totalitarianism, namely liberal democracy, that won out against the hard form, namely communism. In the West, our masters discovered that they could maintain total power on all the issues that concern them while leaving the illusion of freedom of choice. How? Simply by making sure that all options are Jew-safe and Jew-approved. In Genesis book 32, we read that Jacob, who had robbed his brother Esau of his birthright, was frightened to learn that Esau and 400 men were approaching his camp. So Jacob divided his camp in two, reasoning that if one group were attacked, the other would survive. Furthermore, Jacob sent part of his camp to Esau's camp while he remained behind. These followers of Jacob came bearing gifts for Esau, but they could, of course, also act as spies to help Jacob. And even if Jacob's people were attacked and destroyed, some of them would survive in Esau's camp. This bit of unholy scripture is the model of Jewish hegemony to this day. In the early 20th century, Jews were overwhelmingly political leftists and supported the Leninist model of hard totalitarianism. But once their golem, Stalin, had turned on them, many Jews began to reevaluate communism as a tool of Jewish ethnic interests. Thus, to hedge their bets, a series of Jewish communist defectors from communism, but not from the Jewish community, joined the American conservative movement and quickly moved into positions that allowed them to redefine conservatism after World War II. For instance, two Jewish ex-communists, Frank Meyer and Eugene Lyons, were among the surprising number of Jews who influenced the founding of William F. Buckley's National Review. But by far the biggest influx of Jewish defectors came in the 1960s. These were the neoconservatives, most of whom came from the Zionist wing of the Trotskyite movement, which is to say, the most ethnocentrically Jewish wing of the most ethnically Jewish faction of the communist movement. Now that Jewish intellectual movements have redefined American conservatism to accord with Jewish interests on all important issues, it really doesn't matter all that much to the Jewish community whether Republicans or Democrats win elections. Yes, most Jews still prefer Democrats to Republicans. Yes, some of them act like every Republican is an existential threat. Some of them even believe it. But Jews face every issue as if their very survival depends upon it. It's a form of delusion and hysteria that has served them well. But the truth is, from a Jewish point of view, both major parties are the same on all essential issues, and any differences between them do not make a difference for Jewish survival. That is real power, total power, yet soft power. As a corollary, Jewish hegemony means that from a white nationalist point of view, both major parties are the same on all essential issues as well. They are opposed to our racial survival and flourishing. All the differences between them make no difference to us on the most important existential issue. Of course, Jewish hegemony extends well beyond two-party politics into all realms of culture: education, religion, the arts, literature, pop culture, economics, and so forth, ensuring that whites are distracted with an endless array of options as long as they are trivial options that do not threaten Jewish hegemony. This is what we celebrate as freedom. But freedom does not consist in the multiplication of trivial options. Freedom means being able to choose momentous options. And the most momentous option for whites is to choose to get off the road to extinction and back on the road to godhood. That is a choice denied us by Jewish hegemony. Being free under Jewish hegemony means nothing more than being happy slaves. For whites, Jewish freedom means being entertained right up to the point that we cease to exist as a people. If we are to survive, therefore, we have to break Jewish hegemony. How can whites in North America regain control of our destiny? This is the question of how we organize what we call, out of a hope that springs eternal, the white nationalist movement. The most popular movement model has been the political party, which comes in two colors, the Democratic, such as the American Nazi Party, the Populist Party, the American Third Position, and so forth, and the Revolutionary, the National Alliance, the Northwest Front. That is to say, those who seek to come to power within the system and those who seek to overturn the system. Of course, there is no contradiction to pursuing both aims. The NSDAP and the communist parties worldwide have done both. But these are still different political aims which require different kinds of organizations. Thus, every party will tend toward one option or another. Ultimately, we will have to gain political power and keep it. Thus, I believe that whites need political organizations and political experience. but I have no illusions that we are going to vote our way off the endangered species list. Wolves don't let lambs vote on what's for dinner. Nor do I think that white nationalists will be able to launch a revolution or a war of secession against the system as it stands today. So what can we do in the meantime? Furthermore, political parties, whether revolutionary or democratic, are not for everyone. Some people don't qualify for membership. Others don't like being part of hierarchical groups with ideological orthodoxies, not to mention the church-like interpersonal drama that comes with such groups. What can these people do for our cause? Finally, the white nationalist revolutionary fantasy literature of William Pierce and Harold Covington does not sit well with most Americans who do not relish the idea of a Bolshevik-like revolutionary sect seizing power, establishing a one-party state, shooting everyone who opposes them, and dinning propaganda into the heads of the rest. The Jews abandoned Bolshevism to pursue soft hegemony. Couldn't some white nationalists do the same? It is too soon for white nationalist politics. So in the meantime, we need to focus on metapolitics, which will lay the foundations for the pursuit of political power. Metapolitics has two elements. One is propaganda, meaning articulating and communicating our message. And two, there's community organizing, meaning creating a community that lives according to our philosophy today and will serve as the nucleus of a new political order that we seek to build tomorrow. What should be our message? Among other things, that whites are a distinct ethnic group with distinct interests, that we live in a world in which there are real ethnic conflicts, that it is right for whites to take our own side in these ethnic conflicts, that multicultural, multiracial societies make ethnic conflict and hatred inevitable, that ethnic conflict can best be ended by the creation of ethnically homogeneous homelands for all peoples. Finally, that it is an existential imperative, a matter of life and death, for whites to create or preserve ethnically homogeneous homelands for ourselves by any means necessary. Our goal should not be merely to make this the common sense of the political right, but the common sense of the whole political spectrum, of the whole culture, so that no matter what political party wins election, our people will never again have to fear for our survival. We do not need to move people in the right direction along the political spectrum. We need to move the whole political spectrum in the white direction. Our goal need not be a right-wing, one-party state, but a pluralistic society in which we are still arguing about feminism, abortion, environmentalism, and so forth. But the arguments will all be among white people, and no white group will be able to ally itself with non-whites to gain the upper hand against other members of our extended racial family. That is real power. Total power, but soft power, white cultural and political hegemony. And there is nothing sinister about it. It is what existed in America before the rise of today's Jewish hegemony. Yes, white hegemony would quietly restrict our options and frame debates to ensure racially healthy outcomes. But most of us accept limitations on our choices to attain greater goods, such as the preservation of endangered species. Well, whites are the most important endangered species of all. We want a society in which you can choose anything you want, as long as it does not imperil the long-term existence of our race. How can white nationalists pursue this kind of hegemony? We too need to divide our camp and go forth to colonize every shade of the political spectrum. We need to find ways to address our message to every white group and subgroup, for all whites have racial interests. Old-school white advocates tend to be captives of political apparatus thinking. They believe that the struggle is entirely political, and that we will win only when our political team beats the enemy political team. But before we can engage the enemy, we must build up our political apparatus. We have to unify our camp. This naturally leads one to think that the very existence of multiple organizations and approaches to white advocacy is an impediment to our cause, a weakness in the movement that has to be overcome. But all too often, the first order of action is not to attack the enemy, but to attack other white advocacy groups in the hope that one can discredit their leaders, smash their organizations, pull away their members and donors, and unite them behind one leader. The value of the metapolitical path to white hegemony is that it makes a virtue out of necessity, namely the existence of multiple groups and approaches, including multiple political apparatuses. This kind of diversity will always be with us, and combating it is a criminal waste of scarce resources that could be used to attack the enemy. Besides, the best way to attract followers is to attack the enemy effectively, not people who are more or less on our side. To my mind, a diverse array of white nationalist groups and approaches can strengthen our cause in two ways. First, even if there is one right way to save our race, it has not been discovered yet, and it is more likely to come to light if people experiment with different approaches. Second, we whites are a diverse people, and our movement needs to craft messages that resonate with the full range of white constituencies. The more approaches to white advocacy our movement can embrace, the more white constituencies we can address. The key to making diversity within our movement work for us is to create discrete channels for communication and coordination among different camps of white advocates. Such back-channel coordination will maximize our impact and minimize destructive infighting and friendly fire incidents. This form of organization is the topic of a future article.
Hegemony was first published August 20th, 2011, at countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com. Our second segment is Greg Johnson's folk music.
Bleibach is a Slovenian music group founded in 1980 in communist Yugoslavia. Although Bleibach's music is often classified as industrial, that term doesn't begin to capture the band's musical and conceptual versatility. Bleibach's releases run the gamut. Let It Be is a Beatles cover album. Jesus Christ Superstars is a heavy metal concept album of all things about God. NATO is a techno concept album on war, globalization, and Western imperialism in the Balkans. And then there are the two albums under review here, Folk, which is a concept album about nationalism, and Kunstfuge, an electronic realization of Johann Sebastian Bach's The Art of the Fugue. Bleibach is the German name for the Slovenian capital, Ljubljana. The name first appeared in the 12th century, and it became official after Rudolf von Habsburg conquered the town in 1278. The name remained in use until the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1918. From 1943 to 1945, the name was revived when Slovenia was occupied by the Germans. The Germans found many Slovenian collaborators who combined Slovenian nationalism, anti-communism, and pro-German sentiments. After the war, thousands of collaborators were murdered by the communists, and the very name Bleibach was banned. Thus, from the very beginning, Bleibach, the band, was as much about politics as music. Its very name was a challenge to the Yugoslav political order, and beyond that, to all universalist ideologies and homogenizing political and economic systems. Bleibach's flirtation with nationalism does not stop with its name. Bleibach's posters and album covers feature National Socialist propaganda images. In the video of their song Das Spiel ist aus, The Game is Up, the members of Bleibach appear in Nazi uniforms, on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and pushing a shopping cart through a mall, surrounded by shocked onlookers. The effect is hilarious. After the Yugoslav government banned the group from using the name Bleibach, they adopted a simple seal, a cross with four equal arms surrounded by a toothed wheel. Is this an ironic juxtaposition of Christian and communist motifs? Is a cross in a circle meant to resemble a swastika in a circle? Quite a few of Bleibach's songs are sung in German, too, although a good many are sung in English, which is perhaps the group's only concession to the international pop market. But Bleibach cannot be accused of an anachronistic adherence to German National Socialism, if only because of the ambiguous and contingent connection between National Socialism and Slovenian nationalism. Beyond that, Bleibach's work also contains currents of a broader Eastern European nationalism. For instance, lead vocalist Milan Fras appears in headgear that makes him resemble the famous Vienna portrait of Vlad the Impaler, who was a Wallachian nationalist who resisted the power of both Turkish armies and German burghers. Bleibach's 1994 NATO album clearly rejects American and Western European imperialism in the name of the Eastern nation, which I understand as a broad Eastern European nationalism. In light of subsequent events in Serbia and Kosovo, that album now seems prophetic. In 1994, Laibach also created an additional twist to their engagement with nationalism by creating their own virtual nation, NSK, which stands for Neue Slowenische Kunst, which is German for New Slovenian Art. NSK was founded as an artist collective, and it has divisions for music, painting, video, graphics, theater, and theory. It issues passports and postage stamps, and it conducts foreign exhibitions as diplomatic events. Thus, Laibach's overriding theme seems to be nationalism as such. To borrow a phrase from Savitri Devi, they are nationalists of every nation. The folk album certainly supports this thesis. The album's 14 songs are interpretations and transformations of the national anthems of 15 nations, in which fragments of the original words and melodies are embedded in new songs with additional words. Track 1, Germania, is based on Deutschland über alles, the melody of which was composed by Joseph Haydn. The meaning of Germany before all, or Germany first, is simply that, for Germans, Germany should come first in their hearts before all other countries. It does not mean that for non-Germans, Germany should come first as well. Of course, the fact that the song appears first on the CD may indicate that for Laibach too, Germany really does come first. This is Laibach's Germania.
Justice. think you can make it. Deutschland.
Liebach's lyrics ask whether Deutschland über alles will continue to be sung, and more importantly, will it mean anything in the future? Quote, "And in times of misfortune and in times of mistrust, shall this song continue from generation to generation, from present to past? Shall this song continue more than ever in this time of mistrust?" This question is poignant because Germans today are punished by their Allied occupation regime for openly putting Germany first in their hearts, and for expressing nostalgia for the Third Reich, which is the last time when Germans put Germany first. The Third Reich, the war, and the occupation together constitute a historical fall from which Germans must find redemption. Quote, "After the unspeakable, after you have fallen as only angels can fall, go and find your peace again, get back home and grow your tree." The trauma of the fall has, however, induced a kind of collective amnesia. Quote, "No victory, no defeat, no shame, and fatherland no more." All of these are replaced with, quote, "only unity, justice, and freedom for all." I take this to mean a universalist credo that will erase Germany in the hearts of Germans, as a prelude to erasing Germany from the world entirely. Liebach's words conclude, quote, "There will be no memory, or there will be no home." The grammar is a little off, but I take this to mean that unless Germany remembers itself, it will be dismembered, it will perish, there will be no more home. This is, quote, "the lesson you have to learn, now and in the future, do you think you can make it, Deutschland?" Track 2, America, begins with the album's only assault of loud, ugly, industrial noise, and this is a singularly appropriate gesture. It's followed by a montage of the Star-Spangled Banner, the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, the blaring sirens of urban hellholes, the fire and brimstone rantings of televangelists, and Liebach's own accusatory lyrics.
So bright.
The end of history. The end of time. The end of family. The end of crime.
If the Third Reich is Laibach's model of ethno-nationalism, the United States is their model of anti-nationalism. The United States was born with an identity crisis. Culturally and genetically European, the different strands of the American populace could have formed a new European nation with a unified national self-consciousness. But our founding stock was selected for rootlessness and a penchant for universalistic ideological fixations, whether religious or secular. This provided fertile soil for an abstract, universalistic, creedal conception of identity, which became more and more useful with the immigration of ever more heterogeneous and unassimilable populations. America is now no longer a people, but merely a system, a technological, capitalistic plutocracy at war with its founding stock. Beyond that, the American system is at war with every distinct and independent people, with every culture but pop culture, with every ideal but self-indulgence. The triumph of this, quote, universal homogeneous state is what Francis Fukuyama proclaimed the end of history. History ended first in America, and America's mission is to end it everywhere else. It is not a civilizing mission, but a barbarizing one, spread under the banner of emancipation. Laibach asked, quote, O the land of the free and the home of the brave, are you heaven on earth or the gloom of the grave? The answer is both, for the heaven of liberal democracy is the graveyard of all nations, cultures, and ideals. America is, quote, the end of history, the end of time, the end of family, the end of crime. Accordingly, Laibach prays, while mocking the American tendency to inject religion into politics, quote, praise the Lord and praise the Holy Spirit to save us from your freedom, justice, peace, from arrogance and pride, from violence and confusion, your great despair and great depression, satanic verses of your superstition, the land of plenty, your Bill of Rights, free enterprise, the free will and the unbroken one, your self-esteem and self-desire, your trust in God and the religious fire. Track 3, Anglia, is based on God Save the Queen. If the United States is the mighty fortress of the universal homogeneous state, then the United Kingdom is its airstrip one, from which American air power can depart to rain death upon any nationalist upstarts in Europe or the Near East. Amazingly, this utterly degraded and subordinate role in the process of global denationalization coexists in England with a sturdy nationalism, really more of a nostalgia for England's past imperial greatness. Americans shouldn't laugh, however, because we exist in the same position vis-à-vis Israel. Hence Laibach begins, quote, so you still believe you are ruling the world, using all your tricks to keep the picture blurred. Scatter your enemies, confound their politics, so you still believe you are ruling the world. So you still believe you are superior, and all other nations are inferior. Any sedition hushed, and the rebellious Scots crushed, so you still believe you are superior. Unfortunately, British nationalism, like American, has been channeled into the destruction of its own people. Hence Laibach adds a single line to the first verse of God Save the Queen, which functions as the chorus of Anglia. God save you all. This is Laibach's Anglia.
Thank you.
If Liebach think that National Socialist Germany represents the past of nationalism, Track 4, Russia, indicates that they think its future lies in Russia. Furthermore, the band seems to share the surprising fusion of Russian nationalism and communism in the minds of many Russian nationalists today. Russia combines the communist anthem, the Internationale, with the current state anthem of the Russian Federation, which is based on the 1944 Soviet national anthem. Although the current Russian anthem removes the phrase, an unbreakable union, from the old Soviet anthem, Liebach quietly restores it, speaking of, quote, an unbreakable union of fraternal states, united forever in great Russia's embrace. After the fall of communism and the integration of Russia into the global capitalist marketplace, Russians learned that for all its faults, communism at least did not hand the resources of the nation over to international robber barons based in New York, London, and Tel Aviv. To Russians condemned to cold, hunger, and hopelessness by the transition to capitalism, there was a new poignancy to the Internationale. Quote, arise, the prisoners of starvation, arise, the damned of the earth. To this, Liebach adds, quote, let's gather together, let's break us free, the world is changing at its core. Communism, like nationalism, is collectivist in spirit. And in practice, Soviet communism was nationalistic. Thus, the move from national communism to international capitalism was seen as a step in the wrong direction. But what of communism's decades of terror, its tens of millions of victims? These seem to be minimized or forgotten. Or perhaps they have been merely assimilated to the harsh environment, the Mongol hordes, and the cruel autocrats who made the Russians the toughest nation in Europe. Liebach's opening verse captures this fiery, frozen crucible of the Russian character. Quote, united forever in vast, endless space, created in struggle by unhappy race, where sun rays of freedom are frozen in ice, united forever in great Russia's embrace. Ironically, by alleviating such conditions, liberal democracy and consumer society might prove a greater threat to the survival of the Russian nation than communism ever was. This connection between communism and Slavic nationalism is also underscored in Track 12, Slovania, which is based on Hayslavs, the unofficial pan-Slavic anthem which later became the anthem of communist Yugoslavia. Liebach dedicates Hayslavs to the following, quote, these words are for those who died, these words are for those left behind, these words are for you, Poland, and these ones for my homeland. They also dedicate the song to, quote, the spirit of our fathers, the glory of our sons, the power of the specter, which is probably Marx's specter of communism, the Holy Alliance, which is the 1815 alliance between the Russian Empire, the Austrian Empire, and the Kingdom of Prussia against the ideals of the French Revolution. They also dedicate it to lovers, warriors, and all communists. The final lines are cryptic, but they hint at a modern Russian-oriented Pan-Slavism, quote, out of the feudal darkness, away from the nameless one, we stand alone in history, facing east in sacrifice. The references to communism, as well as the Holy Alliance, indicate that the spirit of this Pan-Slavism will be collectivist, anti-liberal, and also Christian. Track 13, Vaticane, is a suitably ethereal arrangement of the papal anthem and march, which indicates that for Liebach, Slovenia's western-looking Catholicism, like their eastern-looking Pan-Slavism, is an important aspect of the nation's identity. Track 14, NSK, is the anthem of Liebach's own state, Neue Slowenische Kunst. Over a march that sounds like it is being played on a scratchy vinyl record from the 1940s, an electronic voice reads the stirring concluding words of Winston Churchill's We Shall Fight on the Beaches speech from June 4, 1940. Tracks 5 through 7 deal with France, Italy, and Spain. Francia is based on La Marseillaise, but Liebach rallies the children of the fatherland not against French monarchists, but against the foreign hordes of African invaders transforming France into an African and Muslim nation stretching from the Congo to Calais.
Let's go, children of the fatherland. Our day of glory has arrived. Against us, tyranny has raised its bloody flag. Do you hear it in the fields and on the streets? The howling of this savage force. They come right into our house to cut the throat of our mother.
Italia is based on the Italian national anthem, Fratelli d'Italia, Brothers of Italy, and it's folk's most straightforward and beautiful adaptation of an anthem. Yet it adds two cryptic and sinister verses describing Italy as, quote, the slave of Rome, and asking Italy if she will die for her freedom or forget her past and its ties. España is a melodic, martial, and triumphant fusion of Spain's wordless national anthem, the Royal March, and the words of El Himno de Riego, the Song of Riego, which is the anthem of the Communist Spanish Republic, It's hard to see how the Communist Republic has anything to do with a healthy Spanish nationalism, but El Himno de Riego is truly stirring as a call to arms. Liebach's interpolations, moreover, have nothing to do with communism, invoking instead the masculine and heroic Christianity of Spanish tradition. Quote, brave is your Jesus, el toreador, and brave is your Jesus, el conquistador. Tracks 8 through 11 deal with non-European nations. Track 8, Israel, is an ironic blending of the Israeli national anthem with the martial Palestinian national anthem. Track 9, Turkey, is based on the Turkish national anthem. Track 10, China, blends the Internationale with the Chinese anthem, March of the Volunteers, for in China, too, communism has fused with nationalism. Track 11 is hauntingly beautiful. It's called Nippon, Japan, and it's based on the Japanese anthem, May Your Reign Last Forever. If you are encountering Liebach for the first time, folk is definitely the place to begin. Musically, it is Liebach's most melodic and accessible recording, yet all the group's distinct sonic trademarks are present. Conceptually, it's the group's most ambitious and thought-provoking project so far, yet it is also rich with humor and irony, but never at the expense of what's good, only at the expense of the enemy. Liebach's latest release, Kunst der Fuge, is a Liebachian electronic realization of Bach's last unfinished work, The Art of the Fugue. I found this choice surprising, but I shouldn't have, since Laibach's earlier works demonstrate a wide knowledge of classical music, including Baroque counterpoint. This is used to droll effect when combined with a monotonous, thumping techno bass line on Nato's cover of The Final Countdown by the Swedish glam metal band Europe. Original instruments purists, of course, would dismiss such electronic performances without a listening, but Bach himself did not write The Art of the Fugue for any particular instrument. And for those of us who first heard Bach played by Walter, now Wendy Carlos, synthesizers are original instruments anyway. I have a number of performances of The Art of the Fugue in various arrangements for piano, organ, string quartet, and chamber orchestra, and Laibach has taken its place among them as a legitimate and sometimes revelatory interpretation. Like all of Laibach's works, there are playful and ironic moments, but the core is deeply serious, even spiritual. At the brink of death, Bach was writing pure, platonic, Gedanken music, and it is Laibach's electronic realization, precisely because of its iciness and its inhumanity, its cold interstellar vastness, that brings this listener right to the edge of eternity. Unfortunately, my favorite track on Kunst der Fuge is nearly 21 minutes long, so I'm going to have to play you two shorter pieces. The first is Contrapunctus 1, and the second is Contrapunctus 8. Contrapunctus 1 gives you a sense of the loftiness and grandeur of this album, and Contrapunctus 8 gives you a sense of the humor and lightness.
Laibach. bug. Live bug. Live bug. Live bug. Live bug.
Is Liebach mystical as well as militant in the tradition of the warrior monks like the Templars and the Teutonic Knights? The closing words of Das Spiel ist aus certainly seem to view European man's struggle for survival from the aspect of eternity. What is risen must pass away. What is past must rise again. We are the devil and we are God. We are timeless and you are dead. Out. The game is up.
Greg Johnson's folk music was originally published under the pen name Oliver Pendleton in the Occidental Quarterly, Volume 9, Number 1, Spring 2009.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.